ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, Australia and Turkey are at loggerheads over the bids to host next year's COP climate meeting. It comes with a multi-billion dollar price tag, but also with the chance to tap billions more in investment and set the global agenda for climate action. Also ahead, Australia exports hundreds of millions of dollars in arms and defence systems every year. The UAE is our biggest customer, and it stands accused of arming the world's worst human rights abusers in Sudan. Have Australian-made weapons been deployed in a genocide? And we voted them back in with an historic majority, so we must have liked what they're selling. But what does the Labor Party of 2025 really stand for?
You don't have this enlivening struggle within Labor anymore. You don't have that debate between ideals and pragmatism. You have the balance. This is the danger for Labor. The balance tilts decisively towards pragmatism.
Sean Kelly was a former advisor to Prime Ministers Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard. He's been around the Labor Party for decades. But in the latest quarterly essay, he asks if this Labor government is up for the good fight. It's so great to be back after such a long break. And can I just say, if any of you listening have endured knee surgery, I sympathise. It hurts. It really hurts. It's meant to be the moment the Pacific's climate message takes centre stage. Instead, next year's UN climate talks, otherwise known as COP31, have turned into a geopolitical tug of war between Australia and Turkey, an argument about place, not goals. The Albanese government wants to hold the COP31 summit in Adelaide in partnership with Pacific nations. But under UN rules, it can't secure the hosting rights unless Turkey withdraws its bid. Today, in an effort to end the standoff before the time runs out, Turkey has proposed a joint leadership arrangement. But Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says no.
We won't be co-hosting because co-hosting isn't provided for under the rules of the UNFCCC. So that's not an option, and people are aware that that's not an option, which is why it's been ruled out.
So that was a big fat no. Australia's bid to host the world's most important climate gathering comes in the same week the opposition has formally rejected a key plank of the Paris Climate Agreement, ditching the goal of net zero emissions by 2050 and pledging more support for Australian coal and gas. Tina Latif was a former director of strategy for COP28, the largest COP summit so far. I spoke to her earlier from Dubai. Tina, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Brian, thank you so much for having me.
Tina, you've been inside these negotiations in the past. How unusual is it to see a COP host selection come down to a very public standoff or stalemate like this?
So, look, it's not unusual. I think we haven't seen it come down to the wire just as much as it has here. I think folks are also quite surprised because we've last week confirmed the host of COP32 in 2027 in Ethiopia. And there remains an eagerness to close out this stalemate between Turkey and Australia. But I would just say for context and those that don't follow these COPs very closely, it's not unusual to have two competing bids. The UAE had the same when we were bidding back in 2022. We had competition with South Korea and then had to resolve that. And Turkey also is not unknown for putting in bids. They did the same with the UK when they tried to host COP26 back a few years ago.
Well, Australia is arguing that it's time for the COP summit to be held in the Pacific, hosted in partnership with Pacific nations, so the world will see firsthand the effects of climate change, given rising sea levels are such a real and current threat for some Pacific nations. How do you think Pacific nations would view the Turkey compromise? Would it undermine the message that this was meant to be the Pacific's moment?
Well, I think we heard the Prime Minister earlier saying that they are not entertaining a joint bid. And Fran, I think, you know, the Pacific has been absolutely clear. Climate change is their number one security threat. It is existential. So Australia saying that it has a very strong interest in the Pacific's development and being the Pacific security partner of choice is something that is very, very tied to this bid. And so hosting COP31, I think, is incredibly important for us, especially as we want to send the strongest signal that we can, that we hear the Pacific when we say that this is their number one priority, their number one security threat, that we stand with them, and that we're prepared to steward the global process in line with a region that has the most at stake here.
At what cost, though, Tina? The coalition is currently urging the Prime Minister to walk away from the bid to host this COP31, criticising it as an expensive vanity project that could cost $2 billion or more, obviously at a time when taxpayers are finding it hard to make ends meet. Could the timing of this announcement hurt Australia's chances? Here we are in the middle of this affordability crisis.
Look, Fran, I think that's completely fair, and I do think that it is imperative on the government, the presidency, when, and hopefully we will win it, to show why this is a benefit to Australians. But look, I will just say, as the coalition sort of spirals within their own climate playbook, as we've seen them do so in the last few weeks, in order to answer the question of what does Australia gain by hosting and is it too costly, we need to understand what is it actually that we would be hosting. So if I can take a step back, every COP has two tracks. The first is the negotiations track, and this is the track that most folks would be familiar with. This is the only global forum where small island states like Fiji, the Marshall Islands, can sit across emitters like China, can demand answers from the world's biggest emitters and accountability. And they have one voice, there's a consensus process, and it is an incredibly important part of accountability, and it's incredibly important for these small island states. And here in this track, our job would be to be the custodian of the process, to create the conditions of agreement, not to push our own agenda.
And
To be a consensus builder. And I do want to say, because perhaps it's not known outside these UN climate circles, Australians are really good at this. Within the UN process, not just within the COP, but in other fora as well, Australian diplomats have been the ones finding common ground and bridges where no one else can. And I think this is something every Australian should be proud of, even if it's quiet diplomacy that doesn't get headlines. But the second part, Fran, that I really want to zoom in on is that outside this sort of formal negotiations process, which we are custodian of, which is incredibly important to the Pacific and all smaller, most vulnerable states, outside the negotiations is everything else. And this is the part that's sometimes dismissed as a trade show. It's called the action agenda. It's the place where the host country can set the agenda and where hosting becomes part of the national interest. And this is the part where, look, I have seen the figures around $1, $2 billion. I don't think it's fair right now, given that the government has confirmed how much it is. There are lots of things that can happen with sponsorships, et cetera, that may bring that cost down. There are estimates that show that hosting COP31 could deliver a 2-for-1 return on investment, where we can leverage, you know, commercial deal making. There's a study that showed that for South Australia alone, we'd be injecting $500 million into the economy. We'd have four times the visitor impact of the Australian Grand Prix in Melbourne. But beyond these numbers, this is the part of the COP that will let us as Australians feature the issues that our voters and our communities really care about. And here I think about the plight of our farmers, regional Australia, showcasing the work of our brilliant scientists and innovators. And it could also be the part where Australia leans into frontier issues that are transforming every single economy, like artificial intelligence, for example, and how that can not only be a massive risk in terms of the energy demands that it will require, but simultaneously one of the new technologies that is potentially going to help every government leapfrog the provision of public service and scale solutions. So the reality, Fran, is that our competitors are positioning themselves for the next industrial revolution across clean energy, digital systems, artificial intelligence, and we have what the world needs: reliable resources, renewables abundance, and scientific capability with deep Pacific ties. So doing COP31 well will bring in a tremendous amount of influence and investment for Australia.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is Tina Latif, who was a former director of strategy for COP28. She joins me from Dubai. That's the theory. In practice, is that what occurred for other nations who have hosted other COPs, the UAE, for instance? Did they get not just a diplomatic boon, but an economic boon as well? Is it quantifiable? That, you know, that there would be investment deals done with Australian research and development and companies?
There absolutely was, and I absolutely think that would be the case also for Australia. And I think that is why many people all over the world are very excited about an Australian presidency, not only because of the moral authority that Australia would have with the Pacific Partnership, but because Australia at this moment in time has a very unique government majority and clarity until 2028, a very clear climate mandate, and I think all of the ingredients to put forward a really important narrative to say, how do we get these goals done? How do we transition into these new industries? And frankly, how do we ensure that this means economic prosperity for all?
So talking about moral authority, another risk factor I've heard cited for Australia is that it could all backfire. It could draw attention to what Australia, hosting this COP perhaps, isn't doing to bring down emissions, including, you know, the recent decision, for instance, to extend the vast Northwest Shelf gas project until 2070. Is our credibility going to be called into question at a global summit on climate? And is that something that any government might be worrying about?
Look, I think that this is a very fair question, and it's one that all COP presidencies will face. It's certainly one that we faced in the UAE. But again, I think particularly if we come back to the importance of this bid as part of our overall strategy with the Pacific has made it absolutely clear this is their number one security threat. And I think that if we stand with the Pacific and we show that we are prepared to steward this global process, which is sacred to them, in line with their priorities, it'll show that we're ready to stand with them with what's most at stake.
Our government is sweating on winning this bid at a time when many countries, some would say most countries, are backsliding significantly on their Paris commitments and promises made at COP summits since. Have these summits and the global push for reducing emissions lost momentum? Particularly, we've seen the US now pull out of Paris. The opposition is arguing that, you know, Australia's goals are much more ambitious than what other countries are actually doing.
Look, I think the US point is one that's always raised, but it's important to remember that 195 countries minus one is still 194. And I think you'll see
it's a big one, though. It's the biggest emitter.
It's an incredibly big one, but I think, and you cannot underestimate the importance and the absence that is currently being felt by the withdrawal of US leadership. No one can deny that. But I would say that there are still 194 countries, particularly those who are most vulnerable and particularly those in the Pacific, in our own region, who view this as the number one issue. I'd also say on the issue of US stakeholders, yes, the federal government has pulled out, but don't be surprised if Australia does win this, if you see a tremendous amount of subnational actors, business actors, philanthropists from the US who are still in and who are still fighting for these climate goals and who understand beyond the moral obligation that we have to act on this to save the planet for our future generations, this is now an economic issue. This is why China, why Gulf states are doubling down on clean tech and clean energy supplies. So Australia is either part of that debate, is steering that debate and leading us forward, or is an observer. And I hope that we're leading and we're at the front.
It also does remain, though, a political issue, not just here in Australia. We've seen the opposition, as we mentioned on the weekend and the last few days of last week, break the bipartisan support for net zero by 2050 commitment to the targets of Paris Climate Agreement, although it wants to stay in Paris and pledge to do that. We've seen that happen here. We've seen the UK government's pull back in face of political pressure and rising power costs, the same happening in a number of developed countries. This is a political issue. Or would you be worried that domestic pressures, political pressures in Australia might also weaken the Australian government's commitment to bid and host this COP, because it's just going to keep the issue front and centre all next year, and that might put them under pressure politically at home?
I think putting aside COP and the COP bid, what we've seen in terms of the fallout with the coalition's dropping of net zero and their spiral with their own climate playbook, the first backlash that they received was from the business community, who first and foremost want to see political certainty. When you have these backflips, when you have this issue become a political punching bag, the first folks that suffer are the ones who are trying to make long-term investment decisions and need political stability. So I think regardless of what we're seeing with COP and whether Australia wins their bid for COP, I would assume that the backlash that the coalition is going to face is not going to only be with their inability or the difficulty that they're going to have in winning inner city voters, but I think with the backlash that we're going to see unfold when businesses are quite upset with the complete regulatory uncertainty that's being created by these political games.
Tina Lateef is my guest. Tina is a former director of strategy for COP28, which was one of the largest COP summits, these climate summits held in the UAE a couple of years ago. Tina, what should Australia be doing right now, behind the scenes or indeed in front of the scenes, if it wants to land this bid?
Well, Fran, I think as far as I understand, Minister Bowen has landed in Belém, has made the journey over. The COP that's happening now in Brazil is in its second week. It should end, I believe, on Friday. So I think we will have a resolution one way or another by the end of the week. Australia can show how we win by showing that we're ready to lead, by not blinking. It's the final hours now. We have what it takes to be good hosts. We have a strong majority government in place with a clear climate mandate from voters. And we have a host city in Adelaide that's shown that they have the infrastructure ready in place. And we also have something, as I said earlier, we have something unique, which is the moral backing of the Pacific, which is crucial to this issue. And so as we look at the week ahead, I know that most global partners see Australia as fair, trusted partners, exactly what a COP host should be. And so we just need to stay visible, confident, and keep making our case. And I'm really hoping that in the next few days we get a positive outcome for Australia and Australians.
And do you have a sense of what's driving Turkey's determination to hold on to this bid as hard as they are in the face of everything you just said there?
Absolutely. So I think Turkey's bid, they will say, focuses on, you know, inclusivity, wanting to be a bridge between developed and developing countries. And they've also made quite a big note of their geographical location. And look, I can't negotiate or dispute geography. Australia is very, very far away. But I really need to stress that as an outsider, the Australia Pacific presidency is unique because it puts the reality of climate change on the table. It'll highlight the challenges facing farmers and regional communities. It'll highlight the frontline impacts that our Pacific neighbours have to live with every single day. And it is an opportunity for Australia to lead on the next frontier, AI and clean industrial systems. So, yes, I cannot dispute that Turkey may offer some logistical convenience, but Australia offers credibility, lived experience, and a region that the world urgently needs to hear from.
Well, under UN rules, if this deadlock isn't broken, the COP summit will revert back to Bonn, I understand. if Australia loses the bid because of this deadlock, what do you see as the diplomatic costs, particularly in the Pacific, where, you know, this government has been working hard to rebuild trust? How important is that, do you think, diplomatically?
Look, I'll just say I know the German assistant minister very well, and he came out very clearly last week and said that he absolutely does not want Germany to host this, and they've urged Australia and Turkey to come to a conclusion. I think,
and yet
look,
they
in terms
haven't.
Of
still,
any,
it's the deadline.
Five more days left. It absolutely is the deadline. And I will say, in all seriousness, there have been folks, including with the Brazilian presidency and in the UNFCCC secretariat, who've said that this is just taking up too much oxygen. So that's why I say, Fran, I would very much hope to see a resolution in the coming days. But look, in terms of the diplomatic costs, if Australia does lose its bid, don't want to hypothesize too much because I'm quite confident and very hopeful that we do win. But I think Australia has an incredibly solid reputation globally. And that's why almost everybody that I speak to is so excited about an Aussie presidency. And as I said, I think Minister Bowen has just landed in Belém. I know that the team is doing their best to close this bid out. I think every Australian should be quite proud of our diplomats who, again, do a lot of really unsung work within this process. And I really hope that we get a decision in the next few days.
I'm sure Chris Bowen is doing his utmost, jawboning, as I say, as we speak. Tina, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Fran. Have a great day.
Tina Lateef was a former director of strategy for COP28. And coming up, Sean Kelly was a former advisor to Prime Ministers Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard and has grown up believing that the Labor Party is up for the good fight. But in the latest quarterly essay, he's posing a difficult question for Labor. What does it stand for? Sean Kelly joining me later this hour. The This week, Australia's spruiking its weapons on the floor of a Dubai arms fair. But little is known really about where those Australian-made weapons end up, with allegations that some are being diverted into Sudan's brutal conflict. The UAE is Australia's biggest weapons market, worth nearly $300 million in arms and ammunition shipped there over the last 5 years. Investigators at the UN say the UAE is arming Sudan's Rapid Support Forces paramilitary. That's the group accused of genocide in Sudan. The UAE denies this, but the horrific images and accounts of mass atrocities in recent weeks have prompted calls for the Australian government to immediately suspend defence exports to the UAE, accusing Australia of doing business with some of the worst human rights abusers on the planet. Michael Shoebridge is a defence expert and director of Strategic Analysis Australia. Michael, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Hey, friend. Lovely to be talking with you.
Michael, Australia has exported nearly $300 million in arms to the UAE over the past 5 years, and it's now spruiking more of its warfare exports in Dubai this week. Do we, Australians generally, know what weapons are being sold, in what quantities, and where they're being used?
No, Fran, unfortunately we don't. And this is something that is a problem that our government and Defence Department could fix if it wanted to. The system of arms export controls that Australia operates is so porous that it is like a bad comedy. So the data that's collected is all about companies applying for permits, and the decisions made are invisible or at least incredibly opaque to anyone besides the officials making them. So we export defence equipment, but we aren't told what or to who, and we never see the grounds for the decision.
And we're talking big business. I mean, one report I've said showed that in the year 23 to 24, those defence export permits issued were in the realm of something like 4,000 export defence permits worth $100 billion. That's a lot of weapons exports.
Well, this is where the defence officials are almost deliberately keeping things confusing, because they'll say, well, the value of the permits actually doesn't relate to the value of what's actually sold, because companies apply for a notional value. We approve it. We don't know what they actually end up selling. This, again, is defence running a system that they can hide behind. But look, we are obviously exporting hundreds of millions of dollars of defence items to the UAE, and it looks like the UAE, whether it's the government or private people, are on-selling some of that to places like Sudan, and that's all bad news.
And just to put some sort of strictures around that, UN investigators have repeatedly and very recently, again, linked UAE supplied weapons to Sudan's Rapid Support Forces paramilitary. And that is the group accused of that very recent and horrific killing in Sudan and genocide more broadly. Could Australia's weapons be diverted into Darfur without Australia knowing? And what weapons
well,
are we
yes,
talking about?
Yes. In fact, the government and the Defence Department have got a system where things can be diverted and break none of our rules. So the Australian system is not like the US system. As soon as the Australian government agrees a permit, it washes its hands of what happens after that. The US system imposes end-user controls on what it sells. So if the UAE buys something from an American defence company, if the UAE then wants to sell it to someone else, they've got to get permission from America. The Australian system is, once we've sold it, we've lost sight of it, over to you. So our system, we know, has deliberate blind spots. And in a situation like whether stuff we sell to the UAE is then onsold or shipped off to a nasty bunch like the Rapid Support Forces in Sudan, we have a system that's deliberately designed to let our government wash its hands of that.
So currently, does Australia have any real way to verify that weapons sold to the UAE aren't being then exported onto, sent onto groups accused of atrocities in Sudan or elsewhere?
Well, we could find out, but none of our systems let us.
But how could we find out?
Well, we could find out through our intelligence connections and our international police connections and by reading reports like the one that the UN has put together. Leaks from that UN report are what are raising all these concerns that the UAE is arming the Rapid Support Forces. So the government has lots of means, whether it's intelligence relationships, law enforcement relationships, or being a member of the UN, to get information. But the problem is the government and the Defence Department almost don't want this information because it would make them have to change their system of export controls.
I want to come back to that. But in terms of what weapons we are selling to the UAE or elsewhere, you mentioned earlier we don't know the what either, but there is a UN database which shows the UAE has received arms and ammunition, parts and accessories valued at close to $300 million from Australia, as I said, over the past 5 years. So these are weapons used in fighting, aren't they?
Yes, they are. It's probably ammunition, and it could be smaller weapon systems. You know, Australia doesn't make large items in any numbers that we could export, like ships, and we don't make any military aircraft. But we do make quite a bit of ammunition and explosives and smaller systems, like remote weapon systems that get bolted onto the back of pickup trucks. So they're the kinds of things that we probably have sold to the UAE. And it does look like the UAE is a place where things leak out of to fuel the conflict in Sudan.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is defence expert and Director of Strategic Analysis Australia, Michael Shoebridge. Michael, under the export control framework and the arms trade treaty obligations that Australia signed on to, what is the legal test for refusing or suspending exports when a recipient state like the UAE is credibly accused of arming a brutal militia, for instance?
Well, our current rules that defence officials administer make them have to take account of the likelihood of the weapons being used to commit human rights abuses or being against our national and security interests. But the problem is defence officials will turn up in places like the parliament and say, yes, yes, we make these assessments about potential human rights abuses, but I can't tell you anything about it because it's an internal decision and the parliament even gets no visibility. So we should force the Defence Department to publish these assessments. Sure, they can keep classified information back, but there should be publicly publishable assessments. We should see the way officials are weighing these factors because when it comes to the mass human suffering in Sudan, we should have high confidence that our officials are making sure Australia has as little part in that as possible.
And if we fail in that, and if our arms are indeed being exported to be used in mass atrocities in Sudan and other places, what legal, moral and reputational responsibility does Australia face if that is found to be true?
Well, the international legal position is probably not going to cause any trouble at all because when you break international law, no one really holds you to account. It's up to you as a nation state to hold yourself to the required standard. But the reputational damage, I think, would be considerable. And you've got to think the Australian public does not want Australian weapons being used by the Rapid Support Forces to commit mass atrocities.
There have been questions, speaking of the Australian public and pressure, there have been questions, repeated questions in the Parliament of the government about military exports to Israel, particularly in the face of the Palestinian death toll in Gaza. The Australian government has repeatedly insisted that it hasn't shipped any weapons or ammunition for the past 5 years, but it is known, it has conceded that Australia is among a group of countries manufacturing parts for the F-35 global supply chain, which is accessed by Israel to maintain its fleet. Now, we are obliged to maintain our supplies of these components under an agreement with the US and Lockheed Martin and don't have control over where they end up. Is this a problem?
Well, it's absolutely a problem. The Joint Strike Fighter program was set up in completely different times, when everyone was very interested in minimizing the costs and also getting industrial benefit if they bought the aircraft. No one really thought about the really difficult problem of what if one of the F-35 users did things that you really didn't want them doing. Because we're all bolted to each other. You know, like a, it's like one of those three-legged races where you tie your leg to someone else, but we're tied to every partner in the F-35 program. And again, defense officials hide behind process here, and so does the government. Now, they say, we don't export anything to Israel for the F-35. They know full well that we do. It just happens to be through the cutout of Lockheed Martin.
And via the US.
Yes, it's like money laundering for aircraft parts. They know full well that Australian-manufactured parts are going to the Israeli Air Force.
So there's commercial imperatives and there's international law. I mean, this year we've had the ruling from the UN Human Rights Council urging nations to, quote, take all means possible to prevent the commission of genocide in Gaza. Does the deal with Lockheed Martin around the F-35, I think we supply some parts of doors or something. You would know, I'm sure.
They're parts for the flaps on the
for
wings
the flaps.
And some landing gear.
Does that abrogate our responsibilities under international law?
I can't see how it can. I mean, it's really just using Lockheed Martin as an intermediary in the supply and sale. So I think we could have more respect for the government if they said, look, yes, Australian parts are on Israeli F-35s. No, we don't intend to veto it because we don't want other countries vetoing our use of the F-35 when we want to use it. At least that would be truthful and credible.
I'm speaking with defence expert Michael Shoebridge. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. Michael, talking about Australia's position now and where we find ourselves now, and the government has been under pressure, as we've mentioned, over the F-35 supply chain, and now there's these questions about UAE. Do you think this has come as a bit of a surprise to the Australian government? As I say, this is a $100 billion industry, it would seem. But I recall a time back in, 2016, the first Turnbull government, where our weapons exports, our weapons industries and defence industries was almost the centrepiece of a manufacturing policy. And it was much vaunted by Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull at that time. And no one seemed to be terribly worried by this. Do you think times have changed?
I do. I think this idea that there's a free lunch from weapons exports is wrong in a couple of big ways. One, arms manufacturing is not a way to a vibrant economy. It tends to be a pretty non-productive use of your capital, whether it's human capital or your finances. So it's not a path to riches. And the second one is, if you want to sell a whole lot of weapons on the global market, you've got to turn a blind eye to who they're going to. And so there are two big reasons that you shouldn't want your economy fired up by defence exports. At the same time, we should want capable defence companies supporting our military, but the idea that's all funded by selling them to the wider world, I think we start to see some of the problems in the Middle East and in Africa.
Except there's exceptions, aren't there? I mean, at the moment, and I think Australians more broadly are tuned into this notion of our defence exports because we've been providing Bushmasters to Ukraine. That seems to be fairly popular. An Australian company is at the cutting edge of drone defence systems that are being sold around the world. I mean, these are Australians, as I see it, reported and received anyway, quite proud of these contributions.
Well, exactly. But why not publish the grounds on which the exports are approved? And if the defence officials were to publish their decision around supplying Ukraine with Bushmasters and counter-drone systems, that would be to absolute applause by the Australian public. But if they were to publish their reasons for not stopping exports that support a genocide in Sudan, they would be condemned, wouldn't they? So we should have public decisions by our bureaucrats around the arms exports rather than them telling us, yes, they consider human rights abuses and security issues and trust us, everything's fine.
Mm. So finally then, what immediate or practical changes to export approvals and monitoring and release of data would you recommend to reduce the risk of Australian weapon systems fueling atrocities?
Well, the Defence Department should collect data on actual exports, not just on permits that companies apply for. They should then publish that data, what's exported when and to whom. And they should also publish their decision-making documents around when they approve or deny exports. And of course, they could keep classified information back, but they could publish those decision documents. Because an informed public is what a democracy is about. And these issues around arms exports aren't just financial ones, they're moral and ethical ones.
Michael Shoebridge, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks, Fran.
Michael Shoebridge is a defence expert. He's the Director of Strategic Analysis Australia. You're listening to the Radio National Hour.
The Radio National Hour with Fran Kelly.
We're well and truly into Anthony Albanese's second term as Prime Minister, and not too much has gone wrong for the government so far. The messaging has been consistent, unity is high, and of course it has that massive majority in the House of Representatives. But still, is there something missing? How about debate, boldness, vision and change? It's the sort of existential dilemma that confronts most of us at some stage of our lives. Who am I? What do I believe in? What do I stand for? Political commentator Sean Kelly pondered these questions as he sat down to write the latest quarterly essay, not so much about himself, but about the Australian Labor Party under the leadership of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. It's titled The Good Fight, What Does Labor Stand For? Sean, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there's the title, What Does Labor Stand For? Seems to me, reading this essay, Sean, that it's dripping with your disappointment in this Labor government. Is that fair?
I wouldn't quite go that far. I think the essay in a way starts with perplexity. I worked with Anthony Albanese. I always found that he had integrity, that he knew his own mind and was absolutely willing to speak his own mind as well. So I don't think he is in any doubt about his own beliefs. And I think when you look at the government, there is a clear Labor hue to what it does, an old Labor hue, if you like. It cares about wages and workers and Medicare. And yet, I have this experience, I have this feeling, which I know talking to people, a lot of people share, which is something puzzles me about this government, that there's some reservation. And as I thought about it and tried to figure out what this perplexing quality was, the word that came to mind that I haven't been able to improve upon is belief. What does this government believe? And that is really the question I've been wrestling with. Because I think when you look at this government, there are often signs that it is heading in a direction that is useful for the country, but then it will kind of pull itself up short. It'll stop short of the best possible answer or the strongest possible action. And it leaves you in this kind of quandary where you think, well, in so many things it does, it does enough to give you a suspicion that there is belief involved, but it never does quite enough to put that matter to rest.
And when you say it, are you really talking, are you critiquing Anthony Albanese and his style and his commitment to going full tilt, as you might say, or holding back?
Look, great question, Fran. It is about Anthony Albanese, the essay, but it is also about Labor structurally, because I think the Labor Party has essentially shifted over the years. If we go back to Labor's history, Labor has always been torn between two poles, idealism on one hand and pragmatism on the other. And that idealism for a very long time in the Labor Party was socialism. You know, not Soviet-style socialism, but some kind of socialist ideal, equality, if you like.
Social Democrats.
Social Democrats. Gough Whitlam talked about socialism. His deputy, Jim Cairns, talked about socialism.
But the world, we don't talk about socialism anymore today in Australia, really, do we?
No, very, very few of our related countries, England, America, talk about socialism very much. And that's, of course, due to the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall. Socialism became a kind of taboo word. And what that means is that once upon a time, we had this landscape of beliefs, people clustered around communism or socialism or anti-communism. And then suddenly we were just in this big, flat plane labeled capitalism. And I think that meant that divisions became kind of specific. The separations between ideologies became a little bit more minor. Now, that has an effect on all of us and how we talk about our own belief. But for the left in particular, it deprived them, I think, of an end point that they were heading towards. And when you're talking about a political party, when you don't have an end point, when you don't have a clear ideal, what you lose is an accountability mechanism. You lose something that you can compare all your actions to and say, well, does this action or this decision bring me closer to that ideal? And I think that leaves you in a space where pragmatism becomes your guiding goal, or really electoral pragmatism. How can I win elections? How can I ensure that I stay in power and my opponents are not in power?
Has that not always been the case, though? I mean, striking the balance between purity of purpose and policy or beliefs and pragmatism has always been a challenge for the Labor Party or for any progressive or party of the left that wants power, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
And a tussle always within.
Definitely. And this is what Labor says. And Anthony Albanese said this to me in 2023 when I asked him about exactly these questions. Is the government ambitious enough? And he said, look, the same accusations were made against the Hawke-Keating government. And he's absolutely right. I think what is different at this point in history is that once upon a time, those debates, that struggle, took place within the Labor Party. And then socialism, that ideal, if you like, died. At the same time, the Greens came along. And that meant that sense of purity, policy purity, migrated outside the Labor Party. And so the Labor Party lost that debate within itself. And in fact, Anthony Albanese now says this very openly. He says, people in our party don't go in with left hats on or right hats on. They go in with Labor hats. The ideological divide is not there. Now, he says that like it's a great thing. But I think what that means is that you don't have this enlivening struggle within Labor anymore. You don't have that debate between ideals and pragmatism. You have the balance. This is the danger for Labor. The balance tilts decisively towards pragmatism.
But a lot of people listening, I think, would say, well, you know, that's a good thing. Left and right, what does that mean anymore? You know, the old adage in Australian politics is elections are won and lost in the centre. And to be centrist is a political goal, it's a political aim these days, because we don't sort of operate on those left and right extremes so much. You're critical of the Prime Minister talking about being there for the vast majority of Australians, but what is wrong with that?
Look, it's a really good question, because in a way every government should be governing for the vast majority of Australians. But I think this comes back to the question of an accountability mechanism, where once upon a time the Labor Party would say, and people would say of the Labor Party, that it was there to stand up for the interests of the working classes. That meant when it did something else, you could legitimately say it has betrayed the working classes. But now it's very hard to say exactly what Labor should be doing. And Labor doesn't seem very willing to say what it should be doing. And instead what we get is a series of phrases that are couched in the negative. So Anthony Albanese talks about doing things the Australian way, which after the election he labelled progressive patriotism. But that started out as not being America, not being like Donald Trump, not copying the ideologies of other nations, is what he said. He talks, of course, about fighting Tories, which is obviously defining yourself by your opposition. And he was asked earlier this year what that phrase, I like fighting Tories, means. And he says it means not giving up the gains that have been made. Now, both of those things, making sure that we don't become like America and making sure we don't give up what we already have, are very conservative sentiments. They are about preserving Australia as it is. Now, that may well be a worthy sentiment, and I suspect it appeals to a lot of people, and it certainly did at the last election. But I think we need to recognise that it is a departure for the Labor Party, that the Labor Party has traditionally been the party of change, as all centre-left governments have been.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour, and my guest is Sean Kelly, political commentator, former political staffer to two Labor Prime Ministers. He's written the latest quarterly essay, which is actually the 100th quarterly essay, and asks, what does Labor stand for? Sean, Albanese is clear with one message. He wants Labor to be the natural party of government. That's a stated goal. Mm. In other words, he doesn't want to fall to at the foot of purity. Pragmatism is key. But also it's a recognition too, isn't it, that the Australian population has changed. We talk about, you know, Labor being the party of the worker, the working class. John Howard recognised that working class had changed a long time ago when he claimed and won, to some large degree, the Howard's battlers, the aspirational tradies, and they, in fact, are a group that move towards the coalition in large numbers. So it's a changing electorate. It's a different picture for a Labor Prime Minister today than it was, for instance, perhaps at the time of Whitlam or even Hawke.
Look, that's absolutely true. And John Howard 20 years ago was talking about the fact that 20 or 30 years before that, you could divide the country into Labor people and Liberal people. And then by the time he was Prime Minister, that group in the middle had widened. There were more swing voters. And now, you know, 20 years after that, we're talking about a much larger group of swing voters. And of course, we know that the two major parties between them struggle to gain two-thirds of the vote these days. So it is definitely a different electorate. And I think what you see from both parties, more recently, more successfully, the Labor Party, is an attempt to reach more people in two ways. One is by designing a bunch of policies that target individuals. And you saw a bit of this at the last election in terms of reaching uni students with debt forgiveness, reaching young people with the first homeowners deposit scheme. And then the second thing is you try and reach a very broad group of people. And the way you do that often is by not offending people. And I think the difficulty here, the difficulty in not offending people, the difficulty in trying to appeal to a really vast range of people, even though on some level, some of that is obviously politically necessary, is that we have real problems in our society right now. We have what I would describe as a pretty much a segregated school system between private schools and public schools, between rich and poor. We know that the school system, I was staggered when I discovered this fact, that the school system increases inequality between advantaged and disadvantaged students by the time they hit year 12 rather than decreasing it. We know that people can't afford to buy a house now without parental help. And so when you are talking about addressing inequality, the truth is that to do so, you are going to have to take some things away from some people. You're going to have to make it harder for those with assets and less hard, easier, for those without assets. And that is going to cause conflict. So the path of least resistance can get you a very long way in politics, but at some point it stops you actually changing the country.
That's true. But if you start to take the moves to change the country, it may end up that you are certainly not the natural party of government. And we saw that, you know, with, Gough Whitlam way back, but we saw it in the 2019 election where Labor seemed to certainly learn a lot of lessons, whether you think they're the right ones or not, from Bill Shorten's defeat. He thought he'd win, Bill Shorten did, and the lesson taken by Labor since then was don't promise too much, too big a giveaways, and don't introduce new taxes to pay for it. Don't be taking away stuff from people. Does Labor need to unlearn that small target lesson, and how do you think they can do that and still win?
Look, I think so. One of the remarkable things last week, as everybody was talking about the 50th anniversary of the dismissal, is how much attention, including from Anthony Albanese, went towards Gough Whitlam's failures, towards what were seen as the problems in the Whitlam government. His achievements were listed as well, but alongside them were, well, there was this instability and there was this difficulty. And I thought, this much later, surely the only real metric we can apply to the Whitlam government is how much did it get done and how much of that still lasts. And an enormous amount. It's probably been more, has a greater legacy than any Australian government since.
Yeah, I mean, I agree on that anniversary. I was struck by every time they put up the list of the achievements, which were groundbreaking social reforms in particular, to education, to women, sex discrimination, divorce, Medicare. I mean, a huge suite of change. But a lot of that's been done, and it was done in a different time. It wasn't a time of 24/7 news cycles. It wasn't a time of social media where, you know, scare campaigns can rush like wildfire through the electorate. Do you think it's more difficult these days for a political leader to stay the course without frightening the horses?
I have mixed views on this, Fran. I think it's really difficult because I think that while it definitely seems harder to us, it's very difficult to tell for sure because not that much has been attempted. And when you look at what has been attempted, the lessons you just reeled off, Julia Gillard, carbon price, also facing into a storm of misogyny, also has Kevin Rudd behind her undermining her. Very difficult circumstances. Bill Shorten trying to make huge taxation changes from opposition. You could go back to Mark Latham trying to make changes to the school funding system, again, from opposition. It is hard to do things from opposition. Anthony Albanese faces none of those barriers. And I would go further. Anthony Albanese is a prime minister who has spent decades of his life in parliament. He has an incredibly experienced cabinet, many of them having worked in the Rudd-Gillard years. He has a huge parliamentary majority, and he faces an opposition which is tearing itself to shreds. It seems to me that Labor has learned the wrong lessons, and it seems to me, moreover, that more might be possible for this Labor government than it has so far allowed itself to believe.
So is what you're talking about incrementalism versus radical change? I mean, this government, on all those things you talked about earlier about inequality in school system, in access to housing, home ownership, I would add healthcare, childcare, the government came in and immediately pledged change. It made change on promises on school funding, the Gonski model, changes towards universal childcare, a whole range of things. But it's incremental. It's not all happening in a rush. Part of that is just budget imperatives, isn't it?
Okay, absolutely. And
they're talking about what you, from your prism, would surely be the right things, aren't they?
I would say they are talking about Labor things. They are talking about the things you would expect a Labor government to talk about. And this is absolutely the thing that always puzzles me, that always makes me feel doubt, makes me doubt myself. And the essay I've written is really an attempt to deal with that struggle, to try and get it down on paper so I can work through it. Because there are days when I despair of this government and I think they are wasting their one precious chance. And there are days when I think, you look at these things, they're important. This is a significant achievement. That is a significant achievement. And there is an argument for incrementalism. There absolutely is. And there is a trap in incrementalism. And the trap is that the date of judgment always seems to be somewhere a little bit further down the track. So my great fear for this particular generation of Labor MPs is that they're telling themselves, wait. They're telling themselves the change is coming, it's building, the small changes will add up to something much larger. And then on the day that they lose power, and nobody knows when that will be, just like none of us know the day that we will die, when that day comes, they find themselves still waiting and they look around and think, oh, we didn't get to do that change after all.
Political commentator Sean Kelly is my guest. His essay in this 100th edition of the Quarterly Essay is titled The Good Fight, What Does Labor Stand For? Talking about that, not having the chance you thought you were going to have, we've talked a little about risk, but what about shame? Do you think Labor is still making up for, in some sense, the shame of the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd years and all the turmoil within them that was their own doing? You know, they lost power, they lost focus fighting amongst themselves, and they lost trust. Do you think that's what Anthony Albanese has lived through and learned and has decided to prove to the Australian people he's a steady hand and this government's focused on the public, not on themselves?
Okay, I do. And I think you can see that in that phrase, the natural party of government. That is historically a phrase that we've used about the Liberal Party. So it is absolutely an attempt to claim a certain legitimacy for the Labor Party in Australian political culture. And I think we have to remember that Labor's history has always had an element of shame to it. And that started off in class politics. It started off with there being a sense that the Labor politicians weren't good enough, and there being vast tracts of society that absolutely thought they weren't good enough, that thought they weren't up to the job. And every time Labor lost power, it was a sense that, they had failed to prove that they were up to that job. And I think that is absolutely something that people who worked in the Rudd-Gillard years carry with them. And I think those politicians who are still there carry that with them. And I worry for them that they have overlearned those lessons.
Well, just finally, Paul Keating once famously said, change the government and you change the country. Do you think that's still true today?
I do. I think Anthony Albanese is changing the country. One of the most interesting things that I think he has said is during the election campaign when he said kindness isn't weakness. And then on election night, he talked about kindness and he talked about caring for other people as Australian values. And I think those are very personal things to Anthony Albanese. And when I think of John Howard and the way that he changed the country, what he did was reflect a certain version of the country back to itself over a long period of time. And I think in doing so, he brought that version closer to reality. And I think that is what Anthony Albanese is trying to do. I think it needs to be matched by significant policy. But, you know, if he manages to drag Australia towards a kinder, fairer place, that will be a very significant legacy.
Sean, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Fran.
That's it from me for today. Feeling pretty great to be back here behind the mic and with you. A very big thank you to Michael Rowland and Kylie Morris for holding the fort, and of course to the Radio National Hour team. I hope you can join me tomorrow. Until then, have a lovely evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.